Big Ideas presents art historian Francis Brune. The lecture, entitled Genius Denied, focuses on the work of the Victorian painter Sir Edwin Landseer. It was recorded at the Women's Art Association in Toronto on May 24, 2010. Big Ideas is a TVO production. For more information, visit tvo.org.
Last year, some of you were here when I gave the lecture for TVO's Big Ideas on the sculpture of Michelangelo. Today, it's your lucky day. We're going to look at the works of the great English 19th century artist Sir Edwin Landseer, and some of you might say that we've gone from the sublime to the ridiculous, but if you did say that, you'd be dead wrong. I hope to prove that as we go along. This is a nice portrait of Landseer with his dog, of course, by Sir Francis Grant. And if you've never heard of either of them, it's not really your fault, because most Victorian art basically went off a cliff. Somebody decided 100 years or so ago that anything that was anecdotal or pretty or sentimental just had to go, basically. So when I was young, this sort of thing was just held up to all kinds of ridicule. I was always fond of it, though, so it was just well known that I had really bad taste. And there were no books, I can't remember any good books written about English 19th century art. A couple of Constable and Turner, they got theirs. There were no courses in universities to learn about it. Most art galleries consigned this sort of thing to their storage vault. So two or three generations essentially were denied the opportunity to see Victorian art and to judge it for themselves. Some of you know I worked at the AGO in the 70s and 80s. A curator there thought it'd be really funny to put up some of their Victorian pictures, large-scale things, wonderful stuff, but he thought it would be a joke. And as soon as it was up, it was quite obvious that everybody liked these pictures, so they were immediately taken down, and they've never been shown since. So that's, again, the shame of it all. Now, nobody's going to suggest, not even me, that Landseer is on the same level as Michelangelo. But nobody is. And not all musicians can compose like Beethoven. So what we do is we take Landseer in the context of his works of his times. We also have to take into account the fact that he was hugely popular in his own day. So his pictures do give us a very clear idea about Victorian taste. Now, the problem that some people have nowadays with him is, to be honest, that the titles of some of his pictures are pretty corny. And there's nothing wrong. This is an absolutely magnificent image of a particular dog, and it's not apparently quite a Newfoundland. It's actually a Landseer named after this very picture. There's a real Landseer. It's good. And so it's a splendid image of this noble beast sitting there on the dock, basically. The trouble is that the title of the painting is a distinguished member of the Humane Society. So that now you're starting to get into the idea of how Victorians saw these things. This is the famous or infamous Dignity and Impudence. I have to say, in Landseer's defense, he just called it dogs when he exhibited it at the Royal Academy in 1839. It's now in the Tate Gallery in London, but actually the last few times I've been to the Tate, it's not hanging, so they may be ashamed of it again. I'm not quite sure. The picture was commissioned by the dog's owner, who was a lifelong friend of Landseer, his business advisor, Jacob Bell. The bloodhound is Grafton. The Scotch terrier is Scratch. So this is anthropomorphic art at its best. The animals illustrate certain human characteristics and personality traits. Now, again, if you don't like this sort of thing, then you may as well... No, don't run out the door. But there's going to see lots more of this, because Landseer is the most famous as the painter of animals, particularly dogs. There was a wonderfully spotty film from the late 60s. This is just the cover of the book that I managed to find last night. It was called The Magic Christian, and it starred Peter Sellers as Sir Guy Grand, who was the richest man in the world. And for some reason, I couldn't quite understand, he adopted Ringo Starr. He was sleeping on a bench in Green Park. So the two of them go off together, basically, with a suitcase full of money. The idea being that you could just, you know, corrupt the most sacred of institutions if the price is right. So you don't get much holier in England than the Oxford and Cambridge boat race. So they show up, they pay off one of the crews. I can't honestly remember which one it was, and that one rams the other one during the race, all sorts of good stuff there. Then they head over into Sotheby's, And there's a very brief scene, I think it lasts about a minute, with John Cleese. I think it's his first ever role in a film. He's just terrific in it. He gets to say one very rude word. You go into the main sale room, and this picture is put up for auction. And obviously, the auctioneer has been paid off. An absurd bidding war goes on between Peter Sellers and a rich American who wants the picture because nobody in Baton Rouge has got a Landseer. And Peter Sellers uses all sorts of silly stuff like cap guns and Veery lights and signal flags. The bidding goes higher and higher and higher, and then a bit higher. And finally, Peter Sellers says, "Too rich for me." The auctioneer says, "Sold to the old twit from Baton Rouge." A fellow comes running in from stage left with a bucket, big bucket of whitewash, writes "sold" right across the face of the picture, and that's the end of the scene. And I mean, it's quite a clever scene, but I think what's most interesting is that in 1969, when the picture was done, the highest bidding that they got to, the absolute absurdity, was £18,500. That, if the picture went out on the market nowadays, that would get you Grafton's nose, if you were lucky, because this would go for millions just because it is so damn Victorian. I mean, it just says everything you want to know about Victorian art. And a couple of other examples of art that, again, to show how things have did collapse for a while. This absolute, if you know Alma Tadema, he's my favorite, I think, of the academic painters, paints marble like nobody's business. This is a picture called The Roses of Heliogabalus. And every day for 4 months, he had roses shipped in from the French Riviera to make sure they're all nice and fresh. He painted this in 1888, by the way. It's a huge thing. It's about 7 feet wide. It's about as big as it is on the screen. It's extraordinarily well painted. It's an absolutely lovely thing. And yet in the 1960s, it was left unsold at an auction at 105 guineas. 100 guineas, £105. And even taking account into inflation, that is absolutely nothing. Now it's worth absolutely millions. Perhaps an even better example how far the pendulum has swung is this glorious thing by Lord Leighton, Flaming June. I mean, it gets so familiar through tacky reproductions. Again, that's the problem with some of these images. Painted in 1895, which, when you think of it, is after Van Gogh is dead already. And there are slightly different versions of the story, but basically what happens is that in the early 60s, it was in a junk shop in Fulham in London. And it was seen there by a 15-year-old boy who really... The asking price was £50. This little boy really, really, really wanted it, but he couldn't get his granny to lend him the money to buy it. So eventually it went to somebody else who liked the frame, hated the picture, wanted the frame. And that little boy was none other than Andrew Lloyd Webber, who has actually said, I think a little bit tongue-in-cheek, that he writes musicals just so he can buy Victorian art. He's got an extraordinary collection. Recently he offered the owner of this picture about £10 million and was turned down. And it's now in the Puerto Rico Art Gallery, so it's never going home, back to one of the great examples of English Victorian art. Some of you have heard my own horror stories about missing out on Victorian pictures 40 or so years ago. So if I just got one of them back then, I'm not stuck here talking to you lot today, basically. So now everything is just out of sight. I was at Princeton in the early 70s. I used to sneak into dark corners with Christopher Forbes, who convinced his father, Malcolm, we'd talk about this sort of thing, because nobody else would. Malcolm Forbes, Christopher said, "I can get you about 200 really, really nice Victorian pictures for the price of that one dingy Monet behind your desk." So that seemed to appeal to Malcolm's Scottish instincts, so that started the Forbes collection, which again is terrific. So once the two millionaires get into the market, there's not much hope for anybody else. So the point I'm getting at in a rather roundabout way is that with this sort of elitism that looked down its nose at Victorian painting, the same sorts of people who sneer at the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber, that stops them from being able to appreciate pictures of paintings by people like Landseer, because pictures like this were popular. And that, for many people, is the ultimate crime. Even, I'm afraid, Degas said something to the effect that the more people like your art, the less good you are as an artist, which is pretty damned elitist. So why would I like, or would anybody like, Dignity and Impudence? And again, I'm not pretending that it's great art, but it's really a very clever picture, I think. First of all, really well painted. Don't forget, everybody at this time, they go mostly to the Royal Academy schools. They train for years and years and years to learn the craft of their art. So the technique here is absolutely wonderful. Grafton, if I can zoom in a little bit, Grafton done with rather smooth and lugubrious brushstrokes that suggest his ponderous personality, and then little deft flicks of the brush that bring out the nervous and excitable character of Scratch. Apart from the witty contrast of the dogs themselves, there's also, you see, at this time you have to keep remembering that the way to respectabilize your art, if you were a Victorian, was to make references to the good old days, the art of the past. So there's kind of a witty pun, if you like, to works like, there was a painter called Herit Dow, who was hugely popular in Landseer's day, not quite so much now, Old Woman Watering Flowers from about 1660. So he was looking at this kind of thing and making a reference to that. Even the fact of the sort of nice old mastery colours that Landseer uses, but also this arched window frame that sort of stabilises the composition, but stuff that juts out over the edge, trompe-l'oeil, pushing out, bulging out into our space, a little bit similarly here, to add a sense of realism somehow. So all of this, again, if you don't like doggy pictures, we have to remember that back then they were taken just as seriously as any other kind of art. This is the critic from the Art Union, which was probably the most respectable, respected journal of the day, the review of the 1839 Academy exhibition. One of the noble hounds, which he places living and breathing upon the canvas, flings a paw massive as iron across the ledge of his kennel. It's impossible to imagine anything finer than the perfect repose and dignity of that magnificent animal, who does not condescend to notice a minikin white Scotch terrier whose brilliant, restless eyes indicate an anxiety to spring upon any varmint that may chance to come within its reach. 1901, a lady by the name of Estelle Hurl wrote a book about Landseer, and there hadn't been much in between, to be honest, until very recently. She waxes lyrical about the picture's beautiful qualities. Grafton's handsome head, she says, is held erect as he surveys an approaching visitor with the air of an elderly statesman receiving a political candidate. There can be no doubt that his opinions are decidedly conservative. See, now, this is all sounds very foreign to us, because I think we've lost the desire or even the ability to read pictures in this particular way, but the Victorians basically had time on their hands. Of course, only Joker Bell owned the painting. That's unique, but through the medium of reproductive engravings, virtually everybody, millions of people, could afford to have a reproduction of this on their walls. So now it becomes a pretty good conversation piece. It helps you to pass the long winter evenings while you wait for somebody to invent television. I mean, the poor dears had nothing better to do, really. So this, I think, is awfully good. Now, the trouble is that I'm not quite so sure about that. Which is called Looking for Crumbs from the Rich Man's Table. This is 1859, so you might say that he's getting on a bit and losing his powers somehow. But this is actually very early. So down the slippery slope we go to comical dogs. These two wired-haired terriers, one of them has a ram's horn, if you can see down the bottom left, and is wearing a Scottish bonnet. The other one wears a lady's cap and has a clay pipe in its mouth. Again, the critics did write seriously about this. One of them said that the artist gives them all the intelligence of the canine nature, but never plays with the falsehood of a fanciful or humanized expression. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds good. To be honest, I don't think Landseer means this to take things like this terribly seriously, but again, it's perhaps guilty by association, because it's not a great leap from comical dogs wearing funny hats to the wonderful world of Disney, A Lady and the Tramp. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course. I think sometimes he's better in a way when he gives us, just keeps us busy, lots of stuff to look at. And we sort of lose a little bit of the immediacy of some of these images, which are very politically motivated for things that were going on at that actual time. This is called A Jack in Office, done about 1833. Jack in office, that's any kind of pompous government official. So the pun here, in a way, is that the main character is a Jack Russell Terrier who sits up here. Again, the critic writing, saying how the well-fed and much-caressed dog keeps others from testing the food of which he has too much. So you sort of read your way around the picture. All the various reactions of the animals, and beautifully painted, the wicker baskets, awfully hard to do, and cringing and cowering and just angry, all of that sort of this humanizing of emotions as you travel around the painting. That's not hugely famous, but this one really is, called Laying Down the Law, or sometimes Trial by Jury, 1840, about 3 feet wide or so, quite big, a meter wide, and again, a fairly savage commentary on the legal profession as a whole, with all kinds of different breeds of dogs playing their parts, and apparently it was inspired by a casual remark. Lanty was having dinner with a judge who mentioned the fact that a certain well-known Frenchman's French poodle would make a capital Lord Chancellor. So that sort of put him in mind of doing something like this. So we see the presiding poodle who's laid down his spectacles and has on the book in front of him. He's about to make some significant pronouncement, surrounded by all the various members of the court who had all looking up expectantly at him. So it really isn't that far, again, I hate to say this, too. I never thought in all my life I'd be showing this in a lecture, but here they are, dogs playing poker, decorating many a trailer park, I'm sure, but actually pretty fancy trailer park. I looked this up just for you for today. Two original versions of this picture recently sold at auction for $600,000 US, because they're now, as in a way, Landseer is part of Victorian kitsch, if you want to read him that way. This is American kitsch. You might not actually know there are 16 different versions of dogs playing poker. I didn't know that either. They were all done by somebody called Coolidge in the early 20th century as part of an advertising campaign for cigars. So again, it's not, I don't think anybody would be pretending that this is good either, but it's really quite funny and quite clever, I suppose. But the strange thing in a way about Trial by Jury is that when it was shown at the Academy's exhibition in 1840, it was bought by William Cavendish, 6th Duke of Devonshire, the famous bachelor duke who should have had elevated aristocratic taste, taste that was formed by the Grand Tour, just all the significant stuff that one saw on the continent. He actually did have good taste, but he liked this picture anyway. And in fact, he even got, I'm pretty sure it's that one in the background, he got Landseer to add in one of his own dogs, just sort of as an afterthought, basically. Not really, I'm still doing doggy pictures, but because it's still in Chatsworth as well, the Duke already owned a Landseer, Bolton Abbey, in the olden time, painted in 1834. And this was partly personal in a way, but also part of the delight that artists had at this time in showing particularly medieval scenes, costumes, characters, all nicely done like that. Bolton Abbey was in fact part of the Cavendish properties, but it was over in Yorkshire, fairly near to Castle Howard. So this is all, you have to get everything right, as we'll see. The people were very picky about incidental details in these paintings. So it's something about, these characters are bringing in food and game, what have you. I'm afraid there's an awful lot of dead things we're going to have to look at today. Nice dogs, of course, and the rather obese monk looked like he's taking in an inventory of all the stuff that's being brought in. The model for the gamekeeper was, in fact, the Duke's Russian coachman, little bits of trivia that come into these pictures. Now, those are all very good. I think this is absolutely Landseer's masterpiece. I would arm wrestle any of you if you argued that this wasn't a great picture. The Old Shepherd's Chief Mourner, shown at the Royal Academy in 1837, the year that Queen Victoria came to the throne, 18 by 24 inches, so really quite small, in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. The kind of picture, again, I'm afraid that's been misread, trivialized, but give it a chance, and you start to realize that it is a genuinely moving picture. Because what he's done is, he's taken a very popular theme with Victorians, the image of the inconsolable lover flinging usually herself across the coffin of her beloved. And then what's normally called Landseer's doggy iconography, he transforms that into this particular image. Now, this isn't quite the right thing I had in mind, but until I get a better one, it's going to have to do, because I just have to sidetrack a tiny bit to an almost relevant story, because years ago I met this beautiful Irish girl who told how when she was very young, she'd had a lover who died, And she went to the cemetery and she threw herself down on the mound of newly dug earth. She tore her clothes. She cut off her waist-length beautiful red hair. She did everything right according to the manual for disconsolate widows. And then she showed up one day ready to do it all again, but they'd finally put up the headstone and she realized she had been all this thrashing around and been done on the grave of a total stranger. So she was cured immediately. She never thought about this fellow another time. So that's my little almost Victorian pathetic story, basically. This, what we see, obviously, the collie, the faithful dog, resting his head on the coffin of his departed master. And there are, again, you have to sort of look around. There are boughs on the floor that have been strewn there by the human mourners who have already, well, they probably just left. They've forgotten their dead friend by now. You can hear them sort of shuffling out the door saying, oh, poor old Wally, let's go for a wee dram. You know, and that's back to normal, basically. So when you look at it, there's not a whole lot going on. But again, if you read up the clues, and again, Victorians read pictures, you start to learn a great deal about the simplicity, the loneliness of this old shepherd's life. His stick and his cap are on the ground. Let me just zoom in again a little bit there. On this simple chair, his book, the good book, presumably, and the spectacles on there. On the other side, look at this lovely pose of the dog as well. We travel across here to the empty chair. Now, see, even that, for Victorians, the empty chair was one of their popular themes, if you like, because it implied the presence, if you like, who had been there earlier. One of these most popular images was done by Sir Luke Fylde. Again, everybody had one of these on their living room walls. Was this is actually Gad's Hill. This is Charles Dickens' study. That's his chair. This was done the day after he died. So it brings with it all sorts of just the whole life, the legend of Charles Dickens is brought alive in this simple motif. I said everybody had this. Some people still do have it. This happens to be my little place, and there it is up my wall. And you can learn an awful lot about people by looking at that. Look, see, there's my, that's me, by my, one of my students did that. There's my Expos hat, my autographed baseballs, my stapler. Oh, it's just pathetic, isn't it? it's a good chance, actually, that Van Gogh, when he was in England, actually saw Fylde's engraving, because everybody did, and that might have tipped him off that it was a good idea to paint his own chair with the simple pipe and the tobacco. That's 1888 when he did that. It's interesting that he gives Gauguin a rather fancier armchair, complete with books and a candle, because he really did think that Gauguin could show him the light to bring illumination, basically. Little did he know. So again, getting back to the lands here, the colours here are muted, appropriately sombre. But there's a nice touch of the light that comes shining in and falls on the coffin from the window at the left. And light, of course, is a symbol of Christ, the one true light, divine illumination. So perhaps the dog isn't quite alone in his private vigil. That's the idea that's put across, at least. The dog, of course, the time-honored symbol of loyalty and faithfulness, qualities highly prized by Victorians. The Latin for faith is fides, which is why you're supposed to call your dog Fido. Now, I don't want to overplay it, but I do think this is one of, or if not the most successful picture painted by Landseer. I mean, it is a genuinely pathetic work in the proper sense of the word. John Ruskin, who was by far the most influential critic of the day, called this one of the most perfect pictures which modern times have seen. He even compared this to the elevated and elevating works of Rubens and Rembrandt. The greatest picture, he said, is that which conveys to the mind of the spectator the greatest number of the greatest ideas. So again, when you look at this, your imagination is put through all sorts of good things. And I think one reason why I like this so much, because the emotions that are inspired by it, there's no dead king, there's no fallen hero, it's just the anonymity of this shepherd. There's nobody, essentially, nobody of any importance except to his dog. So that, I think that's rather nice. Now, just before we get too depressed, again, Landseer is extraordinarily witty, and this is just called Highland Music. 1830 or so, and you don't need any help from me to enjoy just zooming in on the animals themselves, because they're different expressions. I mean, growling and barking and howling and, oh, what the hell's that? And ignoring the whole thing, turning a deaf ear. But again, look at all the... Look, there's a lovely little still life there of his pipe and the jug and things like that. It's so just visually, intricately beautiful. So I always think this kind of thing, it's like Dickens' novels, which are so wordy because, you know, you had to... You like those long descriptions. And so, and the same sort of thing visually. People like to have all of this, the bits and the pieces, faithfully rendered in a painting. Just getting back to the idea of Fido, because there was another article called Britain Riviere, who rather cashed in on Landseer's delight in these kinds of images, in a work called Fidelity, 1869. It's in Port Sunlight, and if you don't know that, you have to go. It's nearish to Liverpool. It's the most wonderful gallery. It's all Sunlight Soap that built the town, built the gallery. They've got a terrific collection of mostly Victorian art that you shouldn't miss. But what we see here, again, this is another image that was enormously popular through the medium of reproductive engravings. And the poacher we see here seated in despair, presumably awaiting sentence. It's got to be execution, comforted by the loyal dog. So again, it's rather obvious what's going on, but I think just as an example of the problems that Victorian artists were up against, because again, there's sort of almost a pedantry. People complained about the picture that you wouldn't be allowed to take your dog with you to jail, so you couldn't have a scene like this, and also that jails wouldn't have comfortable stuff like straw on the floor, so they picked holes in that as well. Now, this is, again, the bonus, if you like, here back to Landseer of including this kind of subject matter but putting it into a medieval context, because this, it's called Suspense, 1834. So what we see here, again, you read around the picture, the faithful bloodhound sitting behind the closed door through which his master has recently been carried, presumably to die. And what we see the gauntlets up on the table, we see the plume of the helmet on the floor, we see the fateful drops of blood at his feet. And again, it's a do-it-yourself approach. You have to complete the storyline. There's no real beginning, there's no real ending. So it's all the do-it-yourself that, that helps to make these scenes so intriguing. And again, people like to chat about things like this. Now, this one, I think, it inspires very generalized thoughts. This one is much more specific, really, so perhaps not quite as genuinely moving. It's called Attachment, about 1829. It's in St. Louis. I'm not quite sure how it got there. But what it's recording is in 1805, a young man called Charles Goff fell off a cliff in the Lake District, and his body was discovered 3 months later, still with his faithful dog guarding him. And it looks almost like he's giving CPR or something, sort of scratching away. Presumably this is done right at the time of the accident rather than 3 months later. There wouldn't be quite so much left for us to see. So anyway, that was became part of Lake District law, essentially. William Wordsworth came to visit this very spot. I mean, you'd expect him to be hanging around in the Lake District, but actually he'd written Daffodils just the year before the accident took place. But also Sir Walter Scott came. Both of them wrote poems about the tragedy, and it was Landseer, when he exhibited this picture in 1829, he did it with a quotation from Scott. Scotland actually had its own version. Some of you may know this. This is Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh, this famous dog. He spent 14 years guarding his master's grave until he himself died in 1872. So, and later on, they rigged up the statue. The clever owner of this pub shifted the statue around, because everybody was standing with their back to the pub taking a photograph of the dog. Now you have, if you take the dog, you have to get the pub as well. So it's all about marketing. Now, I don't think, to be honest, that Landseer ever visited the Lake District. So this is rather a sort of theatrical, sublime landscape. But he certainly had never been to the Swiss Alps. So this is rather made up. But I've put this up, rather dramatic scene up here. Just while I haven't even told you much about him yet, so we have to introduce him, but bear in mind when you're looking at this that he did it when he was about 17, 18 years old. Not bad. Because I think we have to see Landseer as being a far more complex character than he's given credit for, just the dignity and impudence man. On the one hand, he was the darling of the aristocracy, favoured by everybody from Albert and Victorian Albert. We'll see their portraits in just a minute, all the way down to various members of the nobility, basically. But he was, see, the nobility, they had to be seen to be supporting young artists, up-and-comers. And he was good because most artists didn't have good table manners. Lanzier knew how to play the game. He was very... No dinner party was complete without his appearance. He was a real dandy. He wore frilly shirts and had naturally curly hair. Witty conversation. No party was a success until he'd performed his uncanny impersonations of bird calls and barnyard animals. So these are useful talents to have, basically. But he also could appeal to everybody, as I've been implying. The prints, the aristocrats bought the pictures, the prints, the reproductive engravings brought him to the wider audience. I think something like 400 of his paintings were engraved, which has to be some sort of a record. That was the basis of his quite significant fortune that he established. But it gets off to a good start. His father was actually an artist, mostly an engraver called John Lanzier. A couple of brothers, two sisters also became artists. Born in 1802, in London. He was very much a prodigy. He began winning prizes for his drawings when he was 11. That was, again, in adult competitions. When he was 12, he was exhibiting at the Royal Academy already. When he was 14, he began his studies at the Royal Academy schools, and he was so good at animals in particular that Henry Fuseli was one of his teachers. He called him my curly-headed dog boy. He's about 13 or so in this drawing by a friend called John Hayter. He studied the Elgin marbles, which have fairly recently arrived in England. He dissected animals to figure out what was going on inside. He became an associate member of the Royal Academy when he was only 24, which was the minimal legal age. I think Turner was about the only other one who got in that young. Full member at 1831, knighted in 1850. Soon after that, actually turned down the presidency of the Royal Academy. So he's doing well. The dark side of Lanzier is that he was subject to nervous breakdowns. Here's a photograph of him pushing 60. He suffered from melancholia and hypochondria, and he was an alcoholic. So not a very good mix somehow. He was also his own worst critic. He was one of those unfortunate artists who was just never quite able to live up to their own high standards. In fact, he came up with what I think has to be about the best quote ever by an artist. He said, if people only understood as much about painting as I do, they would never buy my pictures. It's good. Anyway, that's back to this picture here. As I say, a teenager when he's doing it. Alpine Mastiffs reanimating a distressed traveller. 1820 it was done. Sold in 1993 for £500,000. And I think it's still in a private collection. I'm honestly not sure where it is. But 1820, it's about 6 feet high, 2 meters high, it's big. 1820, soon after Waterloo, when Europe was reopened to English, Scottish travellers to get onto the continent. So it might reflect their interest in passing through Switzerland, down into Italy, through the St. Bernard Pass. And near the summit of the pass was a famous hospice where the monks went out of their way to help travellers who got into difficulties. And to help them, the monks had bred these marvellous dogs, which later became known as St. Bernard's or St. Bernard's, living lifeboats of these dreadful regions. That's what Lanzier's brother called them. And they were almost unheard of in England at this time. Actually, Lanzier had seen one and done some drawings. So that, I think, would have added to the picture's exotic appeal. As I say, he'd never been to Switzerland, so he kind of rather made up this landscape here. But what we see, basically, is that the two dogs have discovered this poor fellow who's been buried by an avalanche and not looking too happy down in the foreground here, falling out of the picture towards us. And so they're shown here with these huge heads and slobbering jaws. They're digging him out. This one is yelling for help. He's got little bells on his collar, and if you can just see in the back right, the monks are running up the hill towards them. The other dog is leaning over the nearly deceased, licking his hand to revive him. And that it reminds me of one of these hugely popular images, Luke Fildes' doctor gazing down at this young patient. So again, the idea of the caregiving, things like that, really rather similar, that was just done in animal form, basically. The keg of brandy around it. Now, apparently that's totally invented by teenage Lanzier, and now all St. Bernard dogs have to have that around their neck. The last thing you give somebody who's trapped in an avalanche is brandy, apparently. I looked it up. because it does horrible things to your blood pressure. So anyway, that's, he just thought it would look good, so that's what it is there. I don't think there are any statistics. It'd be nice to find out how many people in this kind of a situation woke up to find one of these great, enormous hounds slavering over them and then just drop dead of fright somehow. So I don't think quite as moving, but this is called Saved. And again, it's verging more towards the picturesque somehow with the little girl. And again, I think we've met that dog before, haven't we? The same similar fellow there. And again, you have to remember that Landseer was painting his picture still in his teens. This one, he's all of 23, 24, called The Hunting of Chevy Chase. It's in Birmingham now. He did this for the Duke of Bedford, the sixth Duke, whose wife he was probably having an affair with. Well, he'd meet her again in a minute. The picture inspired by Land. He went up to Scotland in 1824. He met up with Sir Walter Scott, and just fell in love with all of these lovely legends and stories about Scotland's romantic past. In particular, there was a well-known border ballad called just The Ballad of Chevy Chase. It was all about the generations-long feud between the Douglases on the one side, the Percys, the Earls of Northumberland, on the other, just across the border in England. On this famous occasion, the English issued a challenge that they were coming north to hunt on some land that was claimed by the Scots. This great bloody battle ensued. Both Douglas and Percy were killed, most of their men as well. So what Landseer shows is not the actual battle. He did do a picture of that. I don't think it's quite as good. But the hunting scene, because this was a very traditional subject. So he was able to fall back on the work of people like Rubens and Snyders from the 17th century. These rather savage and gory images that Rubens did so well. That's actually a copy that Landseer did of a Rubens with friends that's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. So he knew these things very well. Plus, I think, a reference to the mutual source for both of these, Leonardo's Great Battle of Anghiari, which doesn't exist really. But this is actually Rubens' copy of the central part of the thing. So it's all rather well held in check, I think, by various, you know, compositional means, things like that. But again, to show the problems that artists had, he was taken to task because he didn't get the armour quite right. He's got bits and pieces from the 14th to the 16th centuries. Purists very gleefully pointed out that the Earl Percy's leg business, it's got 16th century parts and then 15th century toes, so that they thought, so now see, you have to be right, you have to go to the British Museum, wherever, and do your research somehow. And again, rather, to our eyes, perhaps rather unhealthy, reveling in violence and savagery in the foreground, but at that time, this was more part of real life. Hunting was the great aristocratic pursuit. This one's called Return from Hawking. And what we see is Lord Francis Egerton and his family, the chap a little bit hidden behind the horses, but clearly dressed as sort of cavalier, throwing your mind back to the good old days, but he's got the big boots and everything like that. This was done 1835 to 37, still in a private collection. And again, it's the idea of elevating the people. It's a sort of a lifestyle portrait in a way. So you've got the wife and the family here, these wonderful animals. The falconer over at the left-hand side, hardly a grovelling serf, as the great sort of raises the bird with this wonderful bravura gesture. But this chap, he had a huge collection, very important, that he just inherited from his uncle, the Duke of Bridgewater. So things, this particular style, rather uplifting, harks back to people like Albert Cuyp in the 17th century, Dutch, again, portraits of various people looking quite nice. And even in the background, I'm not convinced about this, but you see that avenue of trees. People hook that up to the famous avenue at Middleharness by Hobbema, which has actually just been bought by Sir Robert Peel, who was another great friend and patron of Landseer. So other people, once you catch on with a certain class, then everybody else wants something as well. This is now seen in the Highlands with portraits of the Duchess of Bedford, the Duke of Gordon, and Lord Alexander Russell, painted in the 1820s. And more aristocrats who were either Scottish or that liked to come up to Scotland and play at being Scottish, because that was kind of cool. And they're always nicely dressed, lounging around, very comfortable in their surroundings, but certainly very much in control of it. So this is the the girl that, that Landseer had the affair with, almost certainly Georgiana, the Duchess of Bedford. There was a good chance that her youngest daughter, Lady Rachel, was in fact fathered by Landseer, but this was all the good gossip of the day. That's her brother, the Duke of Gordon. I'm not quite sure that I'm in love with some of these characters, because look at this little chap holding up. I mean, that's a bit, needs a bit of a kick in the pants, I think. But anyway, that's again, the sort of rather annoying aspect of some Victorian art. But I think, again, the idea of the kill, the setting, the scenery, all of that. She, in fact, the Duchess, and I should say, in maybe in Landseer's defense, she was much, much younger than her husband, the Duke, and they led totally separate lives. He had affairs, she had affairs as well. But she came up to Scotland, and in a place called Glen Feshey, she built a little village. Somebody else did this drawing of her little houses, and that's Landseer's drawing of a rather more picturesque shed, basically, sort of a crofty thing that she's living in. And they would come up here, and they would dress as Highland lassies, and they would, her poor friends were all dragged up with her, and they had to, I was reminded a little bit of Marie Antoinette at Versailles, dressing up as a shepherdess and sort of flitting around the Trianon. So rather artificial. So finally we get into royalty. Queen Victoria sketching at Loch Laggan, 1847. Now, to show that Landseer is doing well, he and the Queen, they're all staying with the Marquess of Abercorn at his hunting lodge, and they cook up the idea of creating this picture to be given to Albert as basically as a surprise Christmas present. So it's all about kind of appropriate behaviour, because the Queen, she's not looking terribly regal, rather modestly dressed even, but she's been out sketching, because that's womanly work, basically. The two children looking unbelievably Scottish, more than any Scottish people would. This is Prince Edward and Princess Victoria. The gilly here doing an appropriate bit of grovelling. But see, look here, see, there's the kill on the back of the horse. So that implies the presence of Albert, who would be, he's the one who did the killing. That would be his hound, this magnificent dog that provides a kind of nice contrast with the little more sort of family dog on the right-hand side. So this is, again, a kind of a respect to the country. See, for Albert, this is hunting grounds, basically. For the Queen, it's more an object of sublime contemplation as she creates her lovely art. He's awfully good at just introducing people through their animals. This is Albert's favorite dog, Eos. Wonderfully aristocratic with the top hat. It looks like he's going to go on stage and do a little music hall act somehow. He's got the hat and the gloves and everything else, very proudly standing there. This is Dash, which is actually how Landseer came to the attention of the Queen, because it was commissioned by her mother as a present. And now once she's got that, she wants more dogs. This isn't the best reproduction, but there's Dash. These marvellous hunting hats. Again, it's a bit sexist, but this is the pampered luxury life of the woman. The two hunting hounds in the background, Hector, the greyhound, the deer hound Nero, looking like this marvelous heraldic beast somehow. And then in case he gets a little bit too pompous, he throws in Laurie, the parrot, scattering nutshells all over the carpet. So he's sort of almost self-deprecating humor that he brings out rather nicely. This is, again, a kind of domestic scene of happy life for Albert and Victoria and Albert. They're in one of the drawing rooms at Windsor Castle. I don't know if we can quite see it, but that's her old mother being pushed around in a bath chair by a couple of people in the background. They didn't get on that well anyway, so it might be a little bit of a joke somehow. Anyway, here, again, it's rather sexist, because here is the good wife who's got herself all dressed up to welcome home the husband who's been out, you know, had a hard day at the office. Actually, I was thinking, you know, if he stands up, he'd be about this tall, wouldn't he? But anyway, it doesn't look quite right. Obviously, he hasn't been at the office. He's been out slaughtering animals. And again, not to name names, but there's Eos again. All the various animals, all in their various poses, behaving themselves according to their breeds. Wonderful. And this is the Princess Royal, Victoria, doing loving things to a dead kingfisher. And the still life here of all the slaughtered animals, however much we may not like it, is really quite beautifully done. This is, again, another of these, sort of a PR department, if you like, showing Victoria and Albert in, this is still the 1840s, early 40s. And it's they had this extraordinary masked ball, or a costume ball. They all dressed up in medieval outfits. And he gets to be Edward III, she gets to be Queen Philippa. And they did huge amounts of research for all of their costumes. I mean, they went to tomb effigies. That's what apparently Edward III looked like. And again, all the costumes here, not to go into all the details, but this was sort of a make-work project for the English silk industry, which was floundering a little bit. All of this stuff was done at Spitalfields. All of the people of the court ordered their costumes and revived this sort of cottage industry, if you like. All, again, echoing, I think, again, inspired by Sir Walter Scott, who brought this renewed interest in medieval times. Don't forget Edward III. He was the one who initiated the Order of the Garter, things like that. I mean, all the idea of knightly chivalry in the good old days that certainly come out in images like this. This is the Queen of Osborne, just rather quickly to show that. An interesting one, because this is Osborne on the Isle of Wight. Here she is now suddenly in widow's weeds, Albert having died terribly young, of course, only 42 years old. So here she is sort of in her office, sitting on the back of this very sleek horse, reading memos, doing business, but rather messily, because there's all sorts of stuff scattered on the ground and nice dogs here. And that's John Brown. And all, you all saw the movie, so you all know about him. And again, true or not, it's a wonderful story. But I think what's interesting here is that it was based on a photograph. And I can't put them side by side, but he got a lot younger and taller. She got much less dumpy. I mean, this is more the Victoria that we know and love somehow. And here she's a little bit more, you know, youthful beauty, grief-stricken, that much more moving in that sort of way. So staying with royalty, I mean, it's another great chestnut, isn't it, really? The Monarch of the Glen, exhibited in 1851. And it's a splendid picture. It was actually commissioned for the refreshment room in the House of Lords. So it would have been seen through foggy eyes most of the time. But it was now belongs to John Dewar and Sons, the whiskey people, so equally foggy, I guess. Just an extraordinarily grand image. Again, one that's been rather trivialized, but cheapened by overexposure. But it just got terrific power, integrity. Not to mention just the technical brilliance that we look up into the moors and the hills of Scotland. So we see this royal or 12-point stag, the best of the best, the magnificent beast, standing poised, ready for action, the monarch of all it surveys, ready to fight off all comers and to protect its realm. So, of course, it's not just a stag, it's the stag. It becomes an exemplum virtutis, a symbol of strength and pride, all of those positive qualities that made Victorian England so great. But also, don't forget, 1851, that's the year of the Great Exhibition, which Albert had a huge amount to do with, this great showplace, Crystal Palace, for English ingenuity and skills and all of the, you know, propaganda stuff that was going on there. The landscape here, obviously, contributing to the picture's brilliance. It ties in very neatly, 1851. This was about the time that they were starting to build their little retreat at Balmoral. And it was made easier to get to because they had just built a railway line up there. I'm sure the royals were the only people allowed to use it at this point, but still, it made accessible these very remote areas of Scotland. A little bit more depressing in some ways. This is sort of the Canadian content. It's called Man Proposes, God Disposes. Quite late, 1863-64. Basically, it's inspired by an actual event, the tragic failure of Sir John Franklin's exhibition of 1845. They set out with two ships to discover the Northwest Passage. It wasn't until 1857 that a search party, financed by his widow, discovered a few grisly remains, a telescope, some human skeletons. Best of all, for lovers of the macabre, evidence of cannibalism. So this highly charged emotional issue, again, he's transformed it into animal content, because they now represent, illustrate the sublime forces of nature. So one tears with enormous power at the sail that's wrapped around the mast. The other one triumphantly chews at a bone pulled from the skeleton. Other human remains, like the telescope over at the left-hand side. So this is, I think, a rather depressing kind of image, perhaps reflecting Landseer's own state of mind towards the end of his life. You may not know, you do now, that Landseer did the lions in Trafalgar Square. Next time you're there, say hello. Because there, this nice shot, there's St. Martin in the Fields in behind. And this was done, these four splendid beings. I'm worried about this one. I'm surprised that health and safety hasn't come along and put a stop to this. Also, see, look, more Canadian content up at the back there. But this was, he got the commission in 1858, much to the dismay of all the real sculptors. I don't think he'd ever sculpted anything in his life. So now he's got this huge job. It absolutely obsesses him. He did this drawing, My Last Night's Nightmare, it's inscribed. There he is with a lion crushing him beneath. This is just to show he'd been interested in lions for a long time. First of all, he dissected them as a young boy. This is an image of a rather grand fellow who was... he was actually the first lion tamer. He was an American, Amsberg, who stuck his head in a lion's mouth. I just found that as well. See, there he is sort of on the job with these cowering beasties here. But this is much more clever. See, Landseer has put us in the cage. The spectators look in at us, and you've got this extraordinary collection. You've got tigers and lions. You've also got the lamb, so it's kind of the peaceable kingdom. And I'm not sure if this will show up at all, but he's actually got quite a lot of scratches on his arms and neck. Maybe he's not quite as good as he thought he was somehow. But again, you see the lion in the background. That very clearly relates to what we're going. He did a series of hugely strange studies of lions. He got one, he borrowed it from the London Zoo. It died after a few weeks, and he got tired of propping it up and doing drawings from various different positions. So he worked mostly after that from plaster casts that had been done from a lion that had once belonged to the kings of Sardinia. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, this is all part of the law, basically. And then the finished products were finally unveiled. Here he is working away in the studio, these great plaster images that were then cast into bronze. And luckily, when they were unveiled, they really were pretty good. And again, like the monarch of the Glen, they become appropriate symbols of British pride and resolution. He was helped out by a fellow called Baron Carlo Marochetti in this project, who almost certainly did this bust of him. So that's pretty well it for Landseer. Very soon after this, he was badly injured in a train crash. His career as an artist was essentially over. His mental problems persisted. And in fact, his family actually had him declared insane in July of 1872. He lingered on for a year or so until October of 1873 when he died. Shops and houses throughout England lowered their blinds, flags flew at half staff, and the lions in Trafalgar Square were draped with wreaths. He was buried with full state honours in St. Paul's Cathedral. And then he was forgotten. Thank you very much. Thank you.